We've all heard the phrase, it's the best thing since sliced bread. But did you know the inventor of sliced bread is from Iowa? This hour, Iowa Inventors. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. All this week, for Iowa Week, we're looking at facets of Iowa life and history that make up the heritage of our state on Talk of Iowa, as well as here on River to River. This hour, we look at several of many inventors from Iowa. The first computer model, the Gallup pole, the hot dog maker, all invented by Iowans. We'll also hear about Iowan Frank Spedding, a founding father of the nuclear age. Look at Iowa Inventors for Iowa Week, starting right after this news. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. All this week for Iowa Week, we're looking at Iowans who have contributed to the heritage, to the history of our state on Talk of Iowa at 10 in the morning, as well as here on River to River over the noon hour. This hour, we look at several of many inventors from Iowa. The first computer model, the Gallup pole, the hot dog maker, all invented by Iowans. We'll also hear about Iowan Frank Spedding, a founding father of the nuclear age. So many inventions connected with Iowa, and when we got down to it, that we had to leave out a number of them for lack of time. Perhaps a future show will have the stories of the Red Delicious Apple, Eskimo Pies, liquid nitrogen ice cream, the first gas-powered tractor, the trampoline, and the screen door, all connected inventions in Iowa. Not for this show, for perhaps a future show. Now, we've all heard the phrase, it's the best thing since sliced bread. But did you know the inventor of sliced bread is from Iowa? Joining me now, a man whose work in journalism may predate sliced bread. Well, not quite. Bill Wundrum, reporter and columnist for the Quad City Times and its predecessors for more than 68 years, joining us by phone. Bill Wundrum, welcome back to the program.
Well, Ben, it's good to be back.
It's great to have you. Now, you have written for the Quad City Times about the inventor of the sliced bread machine. Who is? Tell us his name.
Otto Rohwedder.
Otto Rohwedder. Otto Frederick Rohwedder. And he was born in 1880 in Des Moines, actually, but grew up in your neck of the woods in Davenport.
Right. But, you know, Rohwedder is the inventor of the bread slicer. But another fella, Art Cotman from Davenport, he should get a slice of the bread. He gets the crust anyway.
Why is that?
Well, listen, Rohwedder invented the machine.
Mm-hmm.
He was a Davenport jeweler. He tinkered with everything. He invented the bread slicer because bread used to be big, clunky bricks that everybody cut and whacked at their fingers. Well, this other fella, Cotman, Art Cotman, he came up with a refined version that wrapped bread in waxed paper.
Hmm.
And, Rohwedder's machine was big and clunky, and when they ran it in the grocery store, it knocked the canned goods off the shelves, literally.
In fact, I see that you can see one of the first, or the first, Rohwedder bread slicing machine. It's in the Smithsonian. That is a monster of a machine.
It's a monster. I mean, it made a success out of Rohwedder.
Mm-hmm.
But Cotman, he was an engineer, and he had some way to put this slicer into the bread, into wax paper, and folded the ends and sealed the wrapper.
So there you had it, the whole thing done. You didn't have to slice it anymore. It
no,
got wrapped
no.
up.
No, and he created a Cotman created a gravity chute that sent the bread and their own weight down into the machine. Listen, the bread that we get today probably is a relative of the way Cotman did it.
You know, what's always fascinated me is you've got a hot loaf of bread, sometimes a soft bread coming out of an oven, and then you cut that without squishing it. Now that's no mean feat, is it?
No. You know, I looked up Roeder died in. Listen, this is recent inventions, and you get right down to it. Roeder died in 1960, and Cotman died in 1988. That's recent. And I looked up the funeral. And Cotman's funeral, the preacher eulogized, let me quote here, every person who has ever made a sandwich should be appreciative of this kindly gentleman.
I wonder if we can think back to the mindset of people then making their sandwiches or whatever they did, eating their bread. Was this, do you get the feeling, Bill, that this was an invention that people were really yearning for, or one that they loved after it was created?
I think they loved it after it was created. They didn't mind slicing bread. You'll still go to the bakery and get just like home-baked bread, and you'll slice it thick. But this machine was uniform. Mm-hmm. It was slick.
Right.
And I often think that there's another angle to this bread business. There's a company in Davenport still doing this, Hansoli. They make the blades for bread slicing machines, and they've been making them since time immemorial. The last time I talked to someone from the company, they said they had no idea how many hundreds of thousands of bread slicing knives that they have made.
Well, there we go. We have it from you. Thank you very much, Bill.
Listen,
Wonder.
Let me add one thing more.
Okay.
Davenport should take advantage of this. We should have postcards that said "Home of Sliced Bread," or T-shirts that say Davenport, where you make your, Davenport, home of sliced bread.
That sounds
hey,
like a, that's a good.
Thanks so much for talking.
That's a good slogan, Bill Wundrum of the Quad City Times, and we will think the next time we open that bread package of Otto Frederick Roeder, the inventor of this bread slicing machine. Bill, thank you so much for telling us about him. I'm Ben Kiefer, and it's Iowa Week on our talk shows, and this hour on River to River, it's all about Iowa inventions and inventors. Hot dog! Well, it may come as a surprise to you that this iconic American food has an Iowa connection, more specifically to prolific Iowa inventor Ray Townsend, who was born in Des Moines in 1913 and grew up there. He died just a few years ago in 2011. Joining us now to talk about Ray Townsend is his son, Ted Townsend. Welcome to our program.
Good afternoon.
Let's cut to the chase, take a big bite, and tell us, what is your father's connection to the history of the hot dog?
He certainly did not invent the hot dog. A hot dog is little more than a sausage. Those have been around for thousands of years. But in 1963, in the family business, he invented the machine that the world to this day uses to make essentially all the hot dogs and a wide range of sausages around the world.
And this machine, is it called the Frank-O-Matic?
It was originally. I had nothing to do with naming it. But,
well, it's a good name, don't you think?
Well, it certainly worked for a long time, yes.
So tell us about it.
It was not the first invention of my father in processing animals into food for human consumption. He founded the company in 1946 on a machine that takes skin off cuts of pork. It was successful. In 1963, this sausage machine came along, and in 1974, a machine that injects pork bellies and a wide range of meat products with a brine solution was invented and brought to the world. The one that has made him most, if the word is properly used, famous, and that you're asking about is this Frank-O-Matic that does make about 99% of all the sausages on the planet.
To this day?
To this day. In fact, that is one of the most remarkable aspects. I'm going to brag on him here a little bit.
Please do.
But in, technologies advance, of course, and inventions, the whole range of technological advancement, typically and certainly in this day and age, don't last very long. One of the most interesting things, I think, about the three times my father brought revolutions to the food industry is that those things he created, again, 46, 63, and 71, are still the precise ways those jobs are done in the food industry to this day, and that's very unusual.
I understand that originally the Frank-O-Matic produced how many hot dogs in an hour?
Well, it depends on the size of the Frank, of course, but to really push the envelope a bit, think of 50,000.
50,000 hot dogs in an hour. How does the machine actually do this?
I was afraid you might ask. This is a question that's much better handled on television, but I'll give you a quick attempt. First of all, the thing that makes the machine valuable, believe it or not, is not in the first instance its speed. It is faster than that job had ever been done before by an order of magnitude at least, maybe a couple. But the thing that makes it valuable is that every single one of them weighs precisely the same amount. And that's what he brought to the industry. But prior to him arriving, the individual hot dog could vary in size and shape and, most importantly, weight by rather a lot.
And it, what was it, hand-produced before that?
Well, in a sense, yes. There was a machine, but the machine operator had to literally hold his or her finger on the place where the meat came out of tube into the casing. And depending on how tight that finger was held, that created the weight of the individual Frank. Needless to say, they all weighed different amounts. And it was a big deal then because unlike, for instance, ground beef, which is sold as a bulk commodity, hot dogs come in distinct packages. They come as hot dogs. Nobody's going to buy a quarter of a franc or an eighth of a franc. And therefore, when it's sold by weight, if a package of hot dogs has a pound of meat in it, the government says you must give at least a pound of meat. To make certain they met that threshold, the individual Franks would have slightly more than their portion of that pound of meat, mm-hmm. ending up giving away meat for free. And the machine that came along and said every single one of them will be identical in shape, size, weight, length, all of that, saved the meat packer astonishing amounts of money. The meat industry operates on very tiny margins, multiplied by massive volume. So if you could save a quarter, an eighth, a sixteenth of an ounce on an individual franc, multiplied by literally millions of Frankfurters over a year, the economic impact of the meat packer was overwhelming. They could not stay in business without this machine.
Mm-hmm. Now, your father went to Iowa State University, and he worked for some time as an engineer at then Des Moines Ordnance Plant and got into to meat processing, I understand. But you mentioned briefly, and before we have to go, please tell us about his prolific inventions beyond this one thing he's so well known for. He went into other areas, boating, aviation, motorcycles. Wow.
My father described his talent as, quote, a funny little quirk of his brain. And it allowed him to see a variety of things in the world in ways that other people had not seen them. As he faded in life, his favorite number was 128. Dad, what's your favorite number? 128. He didn't even remember exactly why it was true, but it's the number of patents he had accumulated in his lifetime. And it does across that range, you mentioned many of them, boats, aircraft. He invented a little stirrup extension that allowed a short man to get on a tall horse. He invented a three-wheeled motorcycle, an internal combustion engine. The list is practically endless.
Mm-hmm. Do you have a favorite invention of his that you just think, that is so darn clever?
They were all pretty clever to me because I did not inherit this funny little quirk.
Darn it. Sorry about that.
Well, so am I, but, you know, that's life for you. I got many other great blessings from him and the world. Of those 128, only three were actually commercially viable, and that's the three I mentioned, skinning machine, Frank-O-Matic, injector. Those are the ones that created the business that today has customers in over 100 countries.
Mm-hmm. Back to the hot dog. Do you have a favorite way to eat a hot dog?
With chili.
With chili, a chili dog. Yeah? Would you say growing up your family had more hot dogs than your neighbors to eat?
Actually, I was around as a kid in the days when this machine was being invented. And the meat emulsion, the actual hot dog before it's cooked, was expensive at the time. And that meant in the experimentation to make the machine successful, they would reuse the meat. One of my jobs as a kid was after the first attempt had been done, my job was to strip the meat out of the casing so it could be reused.
Yum.
Needless to say, after doing this several times, the meat got, well, inedible. And so at that stage of my life, I didn't eat hot dogs at all.
Do you eat them today?
Absolutely.
So your father, very long lived, nearly 100 years old. To what do you attribute his longevity to, this active, curious mind, this what you call a quirk?
Certainly that has a lot to do with it. He also was a fitness buff. He wasn't a bodybuilder or a weightlifter, but he worked on his heart a lot. One small thing that has always interested me, wondering how life would have turned out differently if he was so far, pardon me, ahead of the curve that he had a patent, or actually a trademark on the word aerobic many decades ago. He invented a treadmill that was made for in-home use. This was long before the fitness craze hit. It cost $500, and no one would consider spending such an exorbitant amount of money for a treadmill in the home. Mm-hmm. I think the company sold perhaps a dozen or two to doctor's offices. And then it fell by the wayside, and we didn't exercise the trademark on the word aerobic. But can you imagine what it would mean today to control that word?
Oh, my goodness. Well, thank you very much, Ted Townsend, for telling us about your amazing and quirky father. Sounds like a wonderful father to have, and we thank him for many, many things in our world. Thank you for coming in.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Ted Townsend, president of Townsend Vision, former owner of Townsend Engineering. Iowa Inventors this hour on River to River for Iowa Week. A revolutionary invention now with roots in Iowa that we all have, many of them, I guarantee, in your house, perhaps even in your pocket. Clifford Berry and John Atanasoff invented the first electronic digital computer, also known as the ABC. And here to tell us more about that, Laurel Tweed is program coordinator in the Department of Computer Science at Iowa State University. Laurel, welcome to our program.
Thank you very much.
Now, you've done a lot of research on these two men. Tell us their story and this amazing story of how they came together to work on this computer.
Well, John Atanasoff was a professor of mathematics and physics here at Iowa State in the 1930s, and he was looking for an easier way to solve complex systems of linear equations. So he was doing research, and he'd have equations that he'd need to solve, but sometimes they would take days for him to solve or for his graduate students to solve. So he was looking for a way to make that easier and more efficient. He met Clifford Berry. Clifford Berry was a graduate student at Iowa State and was working with another professor that knew John Atanasoff. And Clifford had a lot of amateur radio experience, and he had a degree in electrical engineering. So he was an ideal student to work on the project that Atanasoff was interested in. So in 1939, they put together a prototype of the first electronic digital computer, and a lot of the concepts that they used are still in use, used in computers today.
Mm-hmm. Can you give us an idea of what this computer looked like or how it worked?
Oh, the computer, it was on a big angle frame, and it was rather large. Actually, the reason why it was never moved out of the physics building that it was built in is because they couldn't actually get it through the door to move it.
Still there today?
It is not. One of the reasons why it took so long for Atanasoff and Berry to get credit for this invention was the computer. You know, World War II disrupted a lot of people's careers and a lot of research that was given the most attention. So in 1942, both of them actually left Iowa and contributed to the war effort in different ways and moved on in their careers. And so the ABC computer was actually kind of forgotten for a while. Mm-hmm. And the patents were never filed by the university. And It was dismantled actually in 1948 in order to make room for other projects.
So there was another until that Supreme Court case, a federal court case in 1973, there was another computer assumed to be the first.
Yes, the ENIAC was developed at the University of Pennsylvania by J. Presper Eckert and John Mockley. And they were widely recognized as having been the inventors of the first electronic digital computer up until the court case decision in 1973. Mm-hmm. And actually, there's a lot of people that think that one of Adam Assoff and Barry's biggest contributions to computing is called the disinvention of the computer, because they participated in that process of proving their prior art. Mm-hmm. So there was a lot of computing companies in the 1960s that really wanted to break these ENIAC patents because it made new developments and new technologies in computing expensive and difficult to do because they would have to pay for the rights to use the technology.
I understand that they received a grant in 1939 from Iowa State to do this for the princely sum of $650.
Well, that was for the prototype. The actual grant for the finishing the complete computer was $5,000.
Okay.
And actually, people can read the grant application on adanassoff.org. There's quite a few original documents we have that Adam Assoff and Barry wrote about this first computer.
It's hard to put our mindset back there, don't you think, to a time before computers. We take them for granted today. They're part of everything. We wear them, and they make our lives so much easier. But to describe that would have been something in a patent application, you think?
It is. It's interesting to read. Even if you don't have a lot of technical knowledge, there are things you can pull from these documents that really make you think that this was just incredible, what they were building. So
Now I'm reading a little bit of a thing about what you wrote about this or collected on this. John Anton Assoff, in 1937, he had sort of a moment there in the winter months of 1937. Can you tell us that story?
Well, yes. He had, looked into many different options that he had at the time for solving systems of equations. And so, one thing he did is he tried stringing together a group of IBM tabulators, which were calculating machines. They were analog machines at the time. And he also built something called a Laplacianometer. It was another one of his inventions in order to make solving equations easier. But there was always a problem. Either it wasn't fast enough or it wasn't accurate enough. And so in his frustration, one of the things he liked to do is get out and drive. So sometimes he would drive really fast and it would clear his mind. And in the winter of 1937, he got in his car thinking about this problem, and he drove across the border to Illinois. Because at the time, Iowa was a dry state.
Okay, we're running out of time. I'm just going to give you inside a minute to go here. Yeah, go ahead.
Okay, so he went, sat down, had a drink, relaxed, and it all came to him. And he wrote it out on a napkin, the four main concepts that he was going to use in his design. And that's how he came up with it and came back to Iowa State and with Clifford Barry invented the first electronic digital computer.
Clifford Barry and John Anton Assoff, thank you very much for telling us about these two gentlemen and the invention of the first electronic digital computer, known as the ABC, the Anton Assoff Barry Computer. Laurel Tweed of Iowa State University, thank you for telling us that bit of invention history in Iowa. Coming up in just a moment, we'll hear about Iowan Frank Spedding, a founding father of the nuclear age. And also, we'll hear about George Gallup. I bet you know what he invented. That's all coming up in just a few minutes. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. And we're back with more of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. It's Iowa Week here on River to River. All this week, we're looking at facets of Iowa life and history that make up the heritage of our state on Talk of Iowa, as well as here on River to River. And this hour, Iowa inventions and inventors. Now let's turn our attention to Frank H. Spedding, a founding father of the nuclear age. As one of the nation's foremost nuclear chemists, he was a longtime icon at Iowa State University. For many years, he directed the Iowa State University Institute for Atomic Research, which became the Ames Laboratory of the U.S. Atomic Energy Commission. And during World War II, he played a pivotal role in the development of atomic energy, work undertaken in the secret Manhattan Project. Joining us now to tell us more about him, Carl Geschneidner, Distinguished Professor of Materials Science and Engineering at Iowa State University. He's also affiliated with the U.S. Department of Energy's Ames Lab and its Critical Materials Institute. Geschneidner was a graduate student who worked with Frank Spedding at ISU from 1952 to 1957. Carl Geschneidner, welcome to our program.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Now, at ISU, Frank Spedding, I understand, led a group of chemists at the Ames Laboratory, which developed an efficient process which came to be known as the Ames Process. Can you tell us what that was about?
Well, that was in the early stages of World War II, beginning of the Manhattan Project, where they said, well, we need to want to make an atomic bomb before the German or the Japanese do, because this would be a tremendous, weapon of mass destruction. They even knew that at that time. And so they had to see if they can initially make the, the atoms fission. And Frank Spedding, because he was a chemist in rare earth materials, he was asked to join them. And he spent most of a week usually in Chicago with the researchers there, physicists and alike. And they asked him to if he could make uranium metal. And, of course, like most of us do, oh, yeah, that's no problem. We can do it. And, they did. At that time, uranium metal cost about $1,000 a gram, which probably today, with inflation, it's $10,000 per gram. So very expensive stuff at that time. And they had to, they needed tons of this metal. And they asked him if he could come up with a process of doing this. And they tried several things. Some worked a little better than others. And they finally eventually came up with the what they call the fluoride method, made the uranium oxide to fluoride and reduced it with calcium, and they came out with the metal, and they started making pounds of this stuff, and then eventually tons of this stuff. And the same process was turned over to industry, and the first atomic pile that was went critical in Iowa State University. Mm-hmm. Produced 3 tons of the metal, which was half the metal that they needed to make the material critical.
Mm-hmm. And, so this has a direct relation to the first atomic bomb.
Atomic bomb with all power reactors, nuclear reactors, and so
forth. That material was produced by what came to be known as the Ames process. That was in
right.
those bombs.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Now, you mentioned Chicago and that atomic pile there. So he was one of the nation's elite scientists who witnessed the world's first nuclear chain reaction at the University of Chicago.
That is correct.
December 2nd, 1942. Did he ever talk to you about that moment?
He did a little bit, but I forgot probably most of it. But all the big names were there. Mm-hmm. And, of course, I was there as a graduate student about 10 years later when I started there. So, things had died down. Things have changed quite a bit. So the emphasis were different. But he did mention it, and he was very proud that he was able to witness the first critical splitting of the atom in the world, which is a real feat.
We all know the name of J. Robert Oppenheimer, the theoretical physicist, often called the father of the atomic bomb, for his role in the Manhattan Project. Though he famously quoted the ancient Sanskrit text after the bombs were tested in the Pacific. He said, "Now I am become death, the destroyer of worlds." And I wonder if Frank Spedding ever expressed to you, Carl Geschneidner, any similar ambivalence about what he'd helped create.
Not really. Not that I remember. I think I might have remembered something like that. But because we were now, engaged in other types of work, and basically I mostly talked to him about my research that was being carried out under his supervision. So didn't get back into history too much. At that time he was director of the Ames Laboratory, which came out of the Institute of Atomic Research, and he had a lot of, political things. He had to go to Washington and, phone calls and all that sort of stuff. So he didn't have a lot of time to, philosophize and talk about things. When we talked about things, we talked about science.
Mm-hmm.
And I had never really, as a graduate student, had a problem getting in to see him. If I had a problem, I'd call up the secretary and I'd have an appointment there within, sometimes within a few minutes, sometimes a few hours, depending on his schedule. But I was able to get into him as a graduate student.
As you mentioned, Spedding's researchers worked in secret under the title the Ames Project, and they, as you described, found new ways to produce and cast uranium. Do you know how many people this involved?
Oh, well, probably at least, I would guess 50 to more than that if you include the technicians and all that sort of stuff at the height of when we were making this material.
Mm-hmm. And so this uranium was extracted and casted long after the Second World War ended.
Yeah, right. Oh, yes.
Uh-huh. And what happened then with the ISU's involvement there after the war?
Well, we got out of the business of making uranium metal. We did make quite a bit of thorium metal because there was a thorium reactor, too, that was being investigated. And the main reason why we, after the war, Frank said, and he said, we have a lot of knowledge here about the rare earth materials and so forth, and we ought to continue this work, expand this work, because to understand the, the atomic bomb and so forth, part of the thing is that the uranium, when it fissions, it has reaction products, and part of those are rare earths. The neodymium and samarium are the predominant ones, and we had to learn a lot about the chemistry of these materials, and that's why we stayed there. As a matter of fact, one of the other big developments that he made, which really opened up the world to our rare earth crisis that we have today, is that they, out of this process, they invented the ion exchange process for separating pure rare earth metals. Once this process became commercialized in the early 50s, he made this material became available to lots of researchers all over the world, and people started studying the properties of these materials and found some very unusual things along the way, and this is eventually has resulted in the use of rare earths and color TV, computers, automobiles, magnets, and so forth. So, and lighting, and as a result of the making available of these materials.
Mm-hmm.
So,
I wonder if we visit the campus there at Ames at Iowa State University, if you can see any structures or artifacts, equipment that takes you back to that time.
About the only thing that remains, I think, was the building that's where they made most of the uranium metal, which was known as Little Ankeny. It was a wooden building, and then it was torn down and decontaminated, and there's a rock out there, a fairly big boulder, with a sign on there which talks about the first building that was there. I don't think there may be a piece of uranium or two laying around someplace that we still have as souvenirs, but I don't remember too many other things from back from that era.
Mm-hmm. When you picture Frank Spedding, what do you picture him? How did he look? How did he operate? What was he surrounded by when he was at work?
Well, he's sort of a short person, probably about 5'6", 5'7", in height, and he was a little bit chubby, a little bit overweight, but not bad when I knew him. What surprised me the most was when he was an undergraduate in high school, he was a track performer, and he loved sports. He played golf, I think, every weekend with some of his colleagues on the course.
Thank you very much. Carl Geschneidner, Distinguished Professor of Materials Science and Engineering at Iowa State University, telling us about Frank Spedding, a founding father of the nuclear age, and the role of Ames and ISU in that. Thank you very much, Carl Geschneidner.
You're welcome. It's my pleasure.
And finally this hour for Iowa Week, as here on River to River, we look at several of many inventors from Iowa. We have to come to the name of George Gallup, creator of the Gallup poll, and here to remind us of that creation, Frank Newport, Gallup's editor-in-chief and the immediate past president of the American Association for Public Opinion Research. He's also the author of Polling Matters, talks about Gallup's impact on journalism and democracy. Frank Newport, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you. It's my pleasure to be with you.
Tell us, if you could, a little bit about George Gallup's early life. He was born in Jefferson, Iowa, way at the start of the 20th century in 1901.
That's right. And he went to the University of Iowa, got his PhD there in psychology. So he was an Iowan through and through, although he left the state and ended up most of his adult career relating to polling here in Princeton, New Jersey, where I am today, although he made some stops along the way, including Hollywood, where he was out frequently. He was a man who was interested in a number of different things by all accounting, one of which was public opinion and letting the public be heard. The other was journalism, which was quite a focus on his point. I believe he was editor of the student paper there at the University of Iowa.
Right, the Daily Iowan.
That's right, evidencing that side of his interest. And then the other side of his interest was psychology, which is what he got his PhD in. And he married the two. And one of the things that George Gallup, Dr. Gallup, was able to do was to take the budding field of public opinion polling that is attempting to measure opinion using random sampling methods or approximation of those methods and marry it with journalism, which is the whole idea that you want to get information back out to the public. And he put those two together, and that was the real reason for his meteoric success and the reason that the Gallup poll became a household name.
Now, in talking about his own background, he said it was his background in, quote, utterly normal Iowa that enabled him to find, quote, nothing odd in the idea that one man might represent statistically 10,000 or more of his kind. So while George Gallup did not invent polling, he did invent the Gallup poll, and Gallup has become synonymous with polling. So what did he change?
Well, he, as is true with a lot of different fields and endeavors, it's rare that one person out of the blue invents anything. So as you mentioned, this idea that you could take principles of statistics, which were in play in agriculture and elsewhere, and apply those to trying to sample the public and then project back to all of the public was one that was out there. And you know, a number of people have been working on it. But what he did was take that and apply it more forcefully. Say, this is important. It's necessary in a democracy. We need to have it. I'm going to go and do it more regularly. And importantly, he said, I'm going to make sure that people are aware of it. And he worked with people in the newspaper business and began to syndicate full pages, like the comic book strips, but it was full pages of Gallup poll results that papers, even back in the Depression into the 40s and 50s, would put in their newspaper and people would wait for them avidly. So what I think that he did, which really stamps his place in history, was to take some ideas that were out there and make them, put them in a form that made them readily accessible by the public and really put the idea that we should pay attention to polls regularly and systematically on the landscape.
Mm-hmm. He called something that he had developed the Iowa method. What's that?
Well, I don't know for sure what the Iowa method is.
Okay.
I know you're there in
Iowa. It was sort of his model of polling, I guess.
Yeah, it may be his model of polling, but that's a new one on me. I didn't know that he had called one particular aspect of what he did the Iowa method, but along with his colleagues, really took a lot of principles and refined them, likely voter models in predicting an election and how you ask questions and how you look at them. He wrote a number of books where he talked about the process and answered people's questions. Then, as is the case now, there was much skepticism about polling. He answered those skeptics. He wrote articles and books, had a good piece in the Reader's Digest, which I was just rereading the other day and so forth. So he was a real advocate for the value of having public opinion recognized and understood in a democracy both here, and he fought for it around the world as well.
You're the author of Polling Matters, Frank Newport. You address in that book his impact, Gallup's impact on journalism and democracy. Describe that in a nutshell, the impact of what he did.
Well, what he did was to advocate the value that leaders need to understand what the people are thinking. You know, the same principle that we have in the American jury system, where we pick 12 of us and we say the opinions that they come to as a group are pretty solid and representative. And he had great faith in the fact that the American public, you know, the bricklayer and the teacher and the nurse and the guy working in an auto factory, all of them have different viewpoints on life, different life experiences, maybe born out of his days there in Iowa. But when you put them all together collectively, they give us a real high level of value in terms of directing society. And that's what he really believed was important, that leaders paid attention to. And I adhere to that myself. He had less respect for leaders and a lot more respect for the people in a democracy.
Now, back in his early days, as he founded the American Institute of Public Opinion, he did something interesting. He challenged other popular techniques, polling techniques of the day. He even made bets with newspapers. He offered newspapers a money-back guarantee that his prediction of, for instance, FDR would be with the winner was accurate.
Yeah, that takes guts. You know, it's easy to do polling, let's say, before an election and keep it quiet to yourself. And then after the election, if the candidate you had ahead wins, you say, look how smart I am. But Dr. George Gallup had the guts to go out before the election and say, this is what my more scientific polling is showing. At the time, particularly in 1936, there was some very popular polling that involved millions of people. His opinions that had been accurate in previous elections that said Roosevelt was going to get reelected, was going to be defeated, and that by Alf Landon, and that became kind of the conventional wisdom that there's no way Roosevelt would be reelected to a second term in 1936. So it took a lot of courage in the face of that strong opinion on the part of journalists and others to come out courageously and say, no, that Literary Digest poll, and that's what it was, a poll associated with a well-known magazine at the time, is wrong. And here I am just interviewing a few thousand people. I'm this upstart, and I'm telling you Franklin Roosevelt's going to win. And that took a lot of courage to stand up and, as you say, make bets and publish it in newspapers and all that. Well, of course, he was right. Roosevelt was reelected, and that was the real start of Dr. Gallup's fame and the rise of public opinion polling in our American democracy.
Bringing Gallup polling into the present, Nate Silver's 538 blog identified Gallup as having among the worst results in the last election, the 2012 election. And he said that Gallup has now had three poor elections in a row, 2008, 2010, and 2012. Gallup predicted Romney as the winner by 1 point in this last election in the final poll of the election. What's gone wrong?
Well, it was too close to call, is what we said. We didn't predict Romney would win. That's inaccurate. In fact,
last poll, though, did have Romney up by one
point. That's right.
That's accurate.
Statistically,
okay.
We said in our write-up that it was too close to call. We did not predict a winner. Most polls underestimated Obama's final percent of the popular vote. We reviewed all of our methods extremely carefully this past spring. Had a major group of academics and others that work with us. We had a major, found some things that we think we need to change, which we have changed. We had a major report on that last June. And I think in this very treacherous environment of predicting pre-election polls, we're back on track now.
Mm-hmm. We've just got a minute or two. Can you tell us the things that got off track that you're going to have corrected for the next polling?
Well, for one thing, it's predicting likely voters, who's going to turn out. Everybody that's in that business has some trouble now because the landscape has been changed. People are turning out in ways that the old models that Dr. Gallup and others developed don't predict as well, you know, higher minority turnout than typically has been predicted. And some other things having to do with more arcane principles of how sampling is done, how we merge together cell phones, which we do now with landlines and some other technical details along those lines.
Mm-hmm.
Are things which can affect one's pre-election prediction.
Just about a minute left, Frank Newport. What would you point to as for you the real challenges in polling with so many polls out there, especially in the political arena?
Well, the challenges in polling are the same that confronted Dr. George Gallup back in the 30s, and that is, how do you take a small sample of people and then accurately project to what's going on among millions of people? The challenge today is he was doing it all in person, picking sampling units across the country. That shifted to telephone polling. One of the challenges now is that a significant percent of Americans don't have landlines. We're incorporating cell phones in half of our interviews that we do every night. But that's tricky, how you blend those together. A lot of Americans now don't talk as much on the phones as they used to. They use texting and other mechanisms, and we and other firms are now exploring how to measure opinions using those types of techniques. So it's a never-changing landscape. challenging pollsters and what's the best way to try to get out there and reach Americans and analyze what they're thinking and feeling.
Thank you for joining us, Frank Newport, Gallup's editor-in-chief and the immediate past president of the American Association of Public Opinion Research. Thank you for telling us about this great Iowan inventor of the Gallup poll, George Gallup. Frank Newport, thank you.
Dr. Gallup was an admirable man. Thank you.
And we've come to the end of River to River, and this is Iowa Week. This past hour, exploring Iowa inventors, and we have more of Iowa Week. It's only Monday. Charity Nebbe is with me. We've got a whole week in front of us.
Right.
This is exciting, isn't it?
It is exciting.
Well, what's coming up on Talk of Iowa tomorrow?
Tomorrow on Talk of Iowa, we're going to focus on Iowa conservationists. And, of course, a lot of people know that Aldo Leopold, the author of the Sand County Almanac, was born in Iowa. So we'll talk about Aldo Leopold and his conservation work. And then we're going to talk about some people that maybe you don't know as much about, Ernest Oberholzer and John Fletcher Lacey and Ada Hayden, lots of people that you
don't know
their stories.
I don't know those names. And
we'll find out tomorrow.
Very good. Thank you, Charity. On River to River tomorrow, we'll focus on medicine in Iowa and pioneering medicine taking place in this state. River to River is produced by Emily Woodbury, Sarah Bowden, and Ben Stanton. Technical support from Dennis Reese. In Ames, help from Jason Burns. In Des Moines, John Pemble helped us out. The executive producer of Iowa Public Radio's talk shows, Catherine Perkins. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us. Tune in again for more of Iowa Week on Talk of Iowa and River to River.